September Maseko has seen it all. This is a prominent former senior technocrat and a political activist from the 1976 generation. He was just a kid dodging bullets during the 1976 Soweto uprisings. He later became a director general and a chief government spokesperson during the Thabo Mbeki years and went on to serve under the Jacob Zuma years. He's just written a memoir, For My Country, Why I Blew the Whistle on Zuma and the Guptas. This is a special podcast for the Sunday Times. Welcome. My name is Sam Mkokeli. So tell us, please, what prompted this exercise? The book itself.
It was a combination of factors. The first one being the fact that my story has been told in so many different platforms. So information is scattered all over the show. So I often get questions about this aspect of my story and that aspect. And I thought it would be important for me to just congregate everything into a single book and tell the story in my own words. Because a lot of what's out there is what journalists write about what I've said and done. And I thought it would be important for me to just tell my story in ways that I experienced the story. But secondly, it was also trying to tell the reader that there's more to me than just talking about the Guptas and what Zuma asked me to do. It was also trying to tell a memoir, my history of where I come from and why I ended up actually defying Zuma and speaking about the Guptas. So the book, it's about also telling young people about what it meant for my generation to be involved in the struggle, the experiences that we went through from the days of the June 16 uprising, how we got involved in politics, what were the risks, what were our experiences, and why we ended up in government, and why what the Guptas are doing or did during the state capture period was something that was an antithesis to our philosophy, our vision of transforming our society. And I thought the best way to capture all of that is through writing a book.
Okay, fascinating. I'm keen to come back to a few things you've mentioned. One of them is defying former president or then president Jacob Zuma, and state capture being the antithesis of the whole struggle and the mission for liberation. But before we do, could you please tell us about the experience itself? The book might have brought up a lot of difficult memories for you, first in your struggle days. Is it correct to categorize you among the leading activists, youth activists in Soweto in the 70s?
Well, in Soweto during the 1976 uprising, I wouldn't even describe myself as an activist then. I was just a kid who had just been exposed to the darker side of apartheid. I mean, being told as a 12-year-old that you are now going to be taught maths in Afrikaans. And I even jokingly say in the book that if the state had its way, then they would have even insisted that my Zulu language must also be taught in Afrikaans. So it was just a rejection of the apartheid language policy that got me involved in the protests and mass meetings and all of the demonstrations and the fighting with the cops in the streets of Soweto. So that's what it was essential about. I was a young kid, I was not an activist. I only became an activist when I got to university, especially University of Zululand, when we had a battle with Inkatha Impis, because as students then, we did not want Gajabu Telezu to come and speak at the graduation ceremony because we saw him as representing the homeland system, as a representative of the apartheid state. So we protested, and in that protest, the campus was invaded by Inkatha MPs, and out of that, four students were killed. one MP also died during that battle. And that basically started raising my consciousness about not just opposing apartheid, but also getting involved. It's only when I got to VETS that I formally became an activist. I joined the Zanin Student Organization, and that's when I became a student leader who ended up participating not just in student politics on campus, but also participating in the establishment of the civic association movement in the townships, working with the trade unions, and ultimately being recruited into the underground structures of both the South African Communist Party and the ANC. So that's when I describe myself as an activist, okay, in the true sense of the word.
Okay. I would imagine then the process of writing this book brought up a lot of the scars you experienced in government, especially in the manner that you had defied the president and how you got shifted painfully to a different position in government.
Well, I must say the writing of the book, I consider, that's why I call it my baby, my third baby, because I found it very therapeutic. My experience with Zuma and the Guptas, at least it's something that I'd spoken about quite a lot. But my other experiences in the struggle were things that I'd locked up in my memory for more than 30 years. The various attempts on my life, when the apartheid state, for example, wanted to take a few leaders of Azazo and COSAS, drive them to Swaziland and actually kill them in Swaziland. because I had a bit of sixth sense, I decided not to be part of that journey. But in that journey, four of our members were actually ambushed. So I realized that, in fact, if I had got into that car, I would have been killed. I would have been one of those who were killed. But it's something that I put at the back of my memory. I never thought about it for more than 30 years. The killing of Bheki Mlangeni was a close associate, a friend, a mentor, when his head was blown off by the apartheid state. It's something that affected a lot of us, me in particular, and many other activists, in a very bad way. But it's something that I'd stopped thinking about for more than 30 years. So in writing the book, I got the opportunity to reflect about how that affected me, what it meant, how I dealt with it. But importantly, the fact that we actually never dealt with a lot of these scars. A lot of activists are walking around carrying a lot of these scars, a lot of baggage. And that's because we never went for any psychosocial therapy support to make sure that we reflect and deal with these things that we went through during the struggle days. So writing my story gave me a chance to actually sit down and reflect on my life, my experiences. Why I'm still alive today is still a miracle. And it's something that I wanted to reflect on through this book.
Okay. So there you are. You're the CEO of the GCIS. You're the chief government spokesperson, speaking for the cabinet, very high profile and senior role in the public service. You find yourself in conflict with the president. How difficult was that?
That was very difficult. I mean, at that time, the whole notion of state capture wasn't something that was generally known, although there were suspicions and allegations that, you know, the Guptas were up to no good. So when I eventually agreed to meet with Ajay Gupta to just understand what he was trying to get from me, I then get a call from President Zuma, who says I must help these Gupta brothers. It doesn't say what exactly help I should give them. But when I get to a meeting with them, then they tell me that they want the whole government communication budget to be transferred into their new media company. And that's when I realized that when Zuma said I must help the Gupta brothers, he was in a sense saying I must be part of this network of an informal, unofficial family that was giving instructions to government. And I felt a sense of betrayal by Zuma because in my mind, somebody who is in charge of the state should not be actively involved in acts of corruption. And in my view, asking me to help the Guptas to siphon cash out of the state coffers was something that I found totally unacceptable. And what was even more depressing for me was that ordinarily, if something like that had happened, the person I should have gone to complain was the president himself, was president of the party and of the state. But here was the person actually giving me some kind of advice or instruction to go and assist the Gupta family. So I found that totally unacceptable, and I felt a little bit betrayed. I did share my experience, this call, with a few leaders, but the reluctance of people within the ANC leadership structures to actually do anything about it at the time was even more shocking. And that's when my disappointment with my party actually began, because I thought if something as unlawful, as corrupt as this was happening, and the party was not willing to act, I began to realize that, in fact, this country was in for a very rough ride.
Okay. Just for the benefit of the audience, how much was the budget? I've seen it in the book, but I'd like to get it from the horse's mouth as it is.
The GCIS at the time was spending up to 600 million rands on government communication. And that money was not sitting in the GCIS government budget. I mean, that's important to note. National Treasury allocated communication budgets to departments, and then we designed campaigns together with other departments and then implemented on behalf of all government departments. And that's how the whole communication outfit worked. And at that stage, no member of the public would have been aware that, in fact, there is an amount of 600 million rands that we're spending on communications. So the fact that the Guptas, or Ajay Gupta in particular, knew that this was an amount that we ordinarily spent per annum gave me a sense that, in fact, he had some kind of information from inside. Somebody was telling him that this was the amount that we're spending. But to answer your question, the amount in question was 600 million rands. And what Ajay Gupta basically demanded from me was that I must approach all the government departments, take out that cash into my budget, and then give it to his media company to actually implement communication strategies and campaigns. And I just told him that, in fact, that's not how things work. And he just told me in simple words that, in fact, I don't understand how things work. This is how things were going to work. And he said if there was a minister that was not cooperating with him, I must come back to him and he will summon them to Saxon World and make sure that they transfer that money to GCIS. So that's how confident he was that he could actually give an instruction to other ministers to transfer the money to my budget.
So had you played along, as did many other people in influential positions in the system, the government would have given 600 million rands that particular year to the Guptas, likely to do the same in the following year and subsequent years. So easily we could have lost billions just solely out of the communications budget.
Yes. I mean, the example of that is the way they went on to take over the SABC. There were these morning breakfast shows that the Guptas organized using SABC as a platform, and all the revenue that came out of that money went into their coffers. In that process, ordinarily SABC would have earned some advertising revenue as a result of hosting such important breakfast sessions where ministers would come and talk about government programs. There are a number of SOEs, Transnet, Eskom, and a few others who also funded and sponsored those breakfast sessions, but all that money was siphoned out and went directly to the Gupta companies. So SABC lost money. So it's a clear indication that they were not just looking for a share of the government communication fund. They wanted to take over the whole budget and make sure that, in fact, it went to them as the Gupta family. So that's how serious this matter was. And that's why I decided not to cooperate with them.
So eventually you tell them to get lost in very colorful language.
Yeah.
It seems that you also shocked yourself at the manner in which you dismissed them.
Yes. I mean, I remember in one of the calls that I talk about in the book, it was when I was driving to Sun City for a weekend away, and he called and demanded a meeting with him. And when I told him that, in fact, I will not meet him on a Saturday morning, and he told me that he's going to get me sorted out, and he'll make sure that he speaks to my seniors and I get replaced by somebody who's going to be more cooperative with them. And that's how, you know, a few months later, I then get an instruction. Minister Chabanu was my superior then, told me that he's got a call from Zuma to remove me from GCIS. And that's how I ended up leaving GCIS and being transferred to DPSA. But it was in no uncertain terms. And Ajay Gupta told me that, in fact, I will be sorted out. And I was indeed sorted out and removed unceremoniously from GCIS.
I mean, the picture you paint in the book, it's an unusual removal from office. Mr. Chabane calls you aside. If you could just take us very briefly about how you find out that you are to be moved.
It was very clear that Ajay Gupta and his companies were very frustrated with me. And in fact, to put it bluntly, they were very pissed off. And I knew that something was going to happen to me because I defied Zuma and I was refusing to cooperate with them. So I'm there, am I sitting in a cabinet meeting, and during tea break, I switch on my phone and I find that I've got tons of messages, and my office calls to tell me that, in fact, E-News channel was running with a story that, in fact, I had been fired. Now, the 2 days before that cabinet meeting, Chabane had called me to his office to tell me that Zuma wanted me out of GCIS by the time he returned to the country. At the time, Zuma was attending the African Union summit in Addis Ababa, and he told Chabane that by the time he comes back, I must be out of GCIS. So I knew something was up, but sitting in a cabinet meeting and then a story is leaked to E-News to say I'd been fired was a big shocker. So I come out of the cabinet meeting, I call Chabane and say, this is the story that's running. He then says, wait, I'm going to talk to Zuma. He speaks to Zuma and then comes back to me and confirms that, yes, it is true, I'm out of GCIS, just like that. No letter, no formal communication. So my departure is announced through the media. And then at the end of that cabinet meeting, Zuma asked Chabane to actually give, to make an announcement about what's happening at GCIS. And Chabane then announces that, in fact, I've been removed from GCIS and I'll be replaced by Jimmy Manye, who now goes around as Mzonele Manye. And then Chabane announces that I'm the new DG in the Department of Public Service and Administration. As he's making the announcement, I almost sank in my chair because he had not had the opportunity to tell me that this was the alternative position. So I learned with the rest of the cabinet members that I'm the new DG of DPSA. And that's how it actually panned out. So I'm sitting in a cabinet meeting, a matter is leaked, and I'm told that I'm being fired from GCIS and replaced by Jimmy and going to DPSA. So that's how it actually panned out. And I still had to go back to my office. In fact, I could not even go back to the office. I just had to tell my staff to start packing my bags because I'm no longer their CEO, as it were. So that's the episode that happened.
And Mrs. Maseko finds out through the media too.
I never had the chance to even tell my family what has happened. So my team, my family got to know about my fate through the newspapers. I still have a lot of respect for Chabane because I think Zuma's plan, which must have been inspired by the Guptas, was that I'll be kicked out, not just out of GCIS, but out of government completely. And Chabane told me that, in fact, he knows that I have not done anything wrong. And he told me that, in fact, he was happy as my supervisor with my performance. And that's why he's not going to let me go into the streets. So that's when he announces that I'll be the DG of DPSA. The unfortunate part is that it appears that he had never had the opportunity to speak to the minister of DPSA, Minister Baloyi, who unfortunately was not at the cabinet meeting. So I had to call him first and tell him before I make the announcement to the public that I'm his new DG. He was equally shocked because he had not been consulted. He didn't know about that I was going to be his DG, but I had to make the announcement and then go and report to DPSA as their new DG. Unfortunately, even for the department, DPSA itself, the staff only heard in the media that, in fact, I was their new DG. And that's, I think, laid the foundation for me not staying too long at DPSA because the manner in which I was actually put in that department was improper. There was not even an opportunity for me to be introduced to the management team or even the general staff at DPSA. I just arrived. And I had to find my way to tell people that I'm the new DG.
That's difficult. So you didn't stay too long at the Department of Public Service and Administration, and you moved on. You left the public sector.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back a little bit to talk about Themba Maseko. In around 1994, you were in Parliament in Nelson Mandela's era. You were a backbencher, I would imagine, very young at the time.
Yeah. 26, 27, somewhere there.
Were you always passionate about working in the public sector?
I was always passionate about being a public servant, being of service to the nation. And that's why when I was leaving university, I was active in civil society movement. So I was an active member of the National Education Coordinating Committee. We're working with parents, teachers, and civic organizations to try and resolve the education crisis that was gripping our country during that period. So I knew, although I had qualified in law, like your brother here, I knew that the best way in which I could give back to my community was to be of service in one way or the other to the public. And the law profession, I thought, would have given me that avenue to participate in ways in which I could assist the poorest of the poor with whatever legal challenges they may be experiencing. And I thought the profession would give me a very good stronghold to address and challenge the apartheid laws that existed. So serving the nation was something that was very important to me. I ended up in parliament not because I had campaigned, but because the ANC ran one of the most democratic processes of selecting MPs. They asked different sectors in civil society to nominate people who could be in the list, and the education sector put my name up, and that's how I ended up in parliament. And I, after 6 months in parliament, I knew that's not what I wanted to do, to sit in parliament and participate in debates and discussions, which in my view were not as productive as they could have been. And that's when I decided I must find another avenue of serving the nation other than being an MP. And that's when the opportunity to be appointed the head of education in Gauteng came up. I was encouraged by the ANC provincial structures in Gauteng to apply for that position, and I was appointed the first DG of the Gauteng Department of Education, with the task of actually setting up the first new non-racial, non-sexist education department in the province. And that's how my public service career was actually launched.
Okay. But before that, you were not just a young junior member of this ruling party. You were very present in many programs before. You got to travel to various parts of the ANC in exile. You met a few of the prominent leaders, including O.R. Tambo. Could you just tell us about that meeting with O.R. Tambo?
I had been involved in the student movement for quite a long time, and part of our mission was to also make sure that we mobilize the international student organizations to support our struggle. But those trips were also an avenue to use the visits to student organizations as a guide to meet with the ANC. So whenever I was in Europe, I would end up in the ANC offices in London. And when I was there, news broke that, in fact, Tambo had been released from hospital and he was resting at home. And I just casually suggested to somebody who was working in the office and said, I would love to meet this man. And a few days later, I was told a meeting has been set up for me to meet with O.R. at his house in London. And it was arranged, and I went to the house. And I must say, I was overwhelmed by the meeting because I was meeting my hero, my idol of many years. But unfortunately, O.R. was not well. I sat in the living room, and they brought him to the room, and the man was clearly struggling to walk. The wife had to help him to walk into the room. He sat down. He could not speak. The wife introduced me to him, and she said, I must tell him what I was doing in who I was and what I was doing in London. I tried to share my story, but within a few minutes, it was very clear that, you know, O.R. had to be taken back to his bed to rest. But it was probably the most monumental, memorable meetings I've ever had with any ANC leader. Meeting my idol was actually the highlight of my political activism. But unfortunately, O.R. was not well. And all he could do was simply shake his head, smile, and wave with his hand. But that was it.
So then, in the democratic era, you worked closely with Thabo Mbeki. President Thabo Mbeki, you were the chief government spokesman or spokesman for cabinet, head of GCIS at the time Thabo Mbeki was president of the country. What was that like?
Working with Mbeki was fascinating in many respects. He was one person who paid too much attention to detail for a head of state. He read a lot. Meetings with Mbeki always meant that you had to know your story, you had to be well prepared. So in my duty as government spokesperson, in most cabinet meetings, I'll always steal a few minutes to just check with him if this is my understanding of the decision, and he'll always give the advice about what I should say. I witnessed him operating in cabinet, the way he chaired those meetings, the way he chaired cabinet makhutlas. You could tell that this was a man who was so involved, engaged, and concerned about issues of governance. He was not always interested in the thrills and frills that are associated with policy. He wanted to know how a policy was going to be implemented, what are the cost implications, and he always made ministers to actually be on their toes all the time. I remember in Cabinet Makhutlas, he spent a lot of time chasing ministers away if he was not satisfied that, in fact, they'd done their homework. I had an encounter with him when I was presenting a proposal on a public works program. I presented it to the Cabinet Makhutlas, and he was clearly not happy. And then he sent me back to go and do some work, called me on a Sunday afternoon to come and present a new proposal. And I spent more than an hour with him at his office on a Sunday afternoon. And preparing for that meeting was also very stressful, because you knew that Mbeki, if you're talking about a subject, especially a topic pertaining to the economy, he would know 10 times more than what you do, because he did his own research, he did his own background search of information, and by the time he was sitting with you, he knew more about the subject than you did. And I found that to be very fascinating, because it basically made me realize that it is absolutely important for everyone working in the public service to do their homework thoroughly, do research, and make sure that you are well prepared. I thought he was a disciplinarian. He never tolerated late coming to meetings, and he was not always tolerant of people who arrive late in meetings. So the government machinery operated like a machine during his time of office. And I think that when he left government, you could see that, in fact, something was missing. From a leadership point of view.
Okay. You had some differences with him, let's say, over the xenophobic issue in 2008?
It wasn't necessarily differences, but it was more about me getting information about the incidents of xenophobia, and I described them as such at a meeting in Durban when he was meeting with international advisors. And I called him aside to tell him about what was unfolding. And I used the term xenophobia, and he actually was not impressed with that, because he said there's violence against foreign nationals, but it's too early to describe that as xenophobia. He said that the country has a history of South Africans integrating with foreign nationals, and we shouldn't just take a few incidents of violence as xenophobia. I was not necessarily happy with his approach, because I thought the issue had the potential of damaging the country's reputation and image globally, and we needed to act quicker to quell that violence against foreign nationals. But that's how he responded to that matter.
Okay, but it was common for you to hold a different position, and you were allowed the space to come across and put it across.
That's the thing about the leadership of the ANC at the time, including Mbeki. He always welcomed people having different opinions and views, but he needed to make sure that when you're expressing a particular opinion, you know your story. You've prepared, you've done your research, you've done your background research, and you're expressing something that you fully knew what you were talking about. But if he felt that you were just expressing a vague opinion without doing your homework, you would really take you to task for that. And that's why a lot of us, when we were dealing with him, we knew that we had to be on our toes. But he did allow room for people to express their views.
At the time, you are an ANC member, still an activist, who travels to the Bulugwane conference around 2007. How difficult was that?
It was difficult because the so-called ANC factionalism had already set in big ways. And unfortunately, those Zuma supporters started perceiving those of us who were working in the Mbeki administration as part of the Mbeki faction. So interacting with ANC comrades became very difficult because they started perceiving everybody, or perceiving me as somebody working in Thabo Mbeki's administration. And because GCIS is part of the presidency, the assumption was that I'm part of the Mbeki faction. So going to ANC meetings became increasingly difficult. Polokwane in particular was quite tough because Mbeki was contesting the election and I was seen as part of the Mbeki faction. So I felt extremely unwelcome. I mean, I describe an incident where I stopped over for a drink at a pub in Petersburg, in Polokwane now. And there were noises that you got from other patrons were there. And it was clear that the majority of people in that pub were Zuma supporters. And I felt extremely uncomfortable and ended up walking out. During the course of the conference itself, I'll be walking outside the tent, just having a chat or being on the phone. And they will hell insulted me to say, you know, here I'm Mbeki people and we're going to deal with them, et cetera, et cetera. So it became so uncomfortable that after the election of the president at the conference was announced, I just felt so uncomfortable and at times even feeling unsafe because there were these crowds of people who were moving around the tent, outside the tent, singing pro-Zuma songs, and they were making a lot of us feel uncomfortable. And I decided to leave the conference. I did not stay till the end.
Okay. So just looking at the various facets of who you are, student activist who goes and meets O.R. Tambo, senior technocrat working with the likes of Thabo Mbeki, you get moved out of your position in a very dramatic fashion, and Jimmy Manyi replaces you. What does that mean?
Well, it means that I'd run my course in the public service. I think that a message had been sent out to me to say I'm not the right kind of civil servant the new administration wanted to see. And it became very clear, observing the type of appointments that were made by the Zuma administration, it became very clear that, in fact, they were looking for a certain kind of human being to be appointed in senior positions in government and state-owned enterprises. And these were individuals who would not question the new administration. So these were individuals who would be amenable to approaches by groups such as the Gupta family. And these were people who did not have the history of involvement in struggles. So derailing the revolution is not something they would understand, or it would not mean anything to them. And those are the kinds of people that were preferred by many of the new leaders who came into government, political leaders who came into government at that stage. And it led to what I term the juniorization of the public service right to the top, because the view was that if you get these new individuals to come in, they're junior, they didn't understand the history of the movement, they wouldn't question the ministers, and therefore the new political leaders will get their way from these individuals. And I saw the beginning of a decline in the morality of the state as soon as that trend started emerging.
Then a couple of months later, or even a year or two later, you speak out about what happened. What prompted that?
Look, I'd left government in 2011 and had enough time to reflect and observe government as an outsider after almost 18 years being an insider in government. And I started observing trends which gave me the impression that, in fact, something bigger was wrong within government circles. Because initially, when I was removed from GCIS, I thought this was simply about the Guptas interested in the budget of GCIS. And I thought I didn't see the picture, the bigger picture beyond that. But as an unemployed person, I had enough time in my hands. I started observing what was unfolding, and it became very clear to me that something bigger was taking place. And there are a couple of incidents that sprang to mind. One was it a BRICS summit or something, a summit taking place in Durban, when I saw Zoom, an announcement being made that the presidents were walking into the room, and Zuma was being led by one of the Gupta brothers. I think it was Tony Gupta or Ajay Gupta. And I found that totally unacceptable, because in government meetings, it's only government people who are involved. You don't have a private person leading a government delegation into a global summit such as that one. And I thought there's something wrong with it. Then I started seeing stories about the landing of the jet, the Gupta jet, at Waterkloof military base. Then I read stories about Mcebisi Jonas being offered a bribe of 600 million rands by the Guptas. And then I watched videos on television about ministers trying to justify the expenditure on Inkandla, particularly the swimming pool, the dramatic swimming pool briefing that was conducted by a few ministers. Then I watched President Zuma speaking in Parliament and many other fora, basically saying that he has never assisted the Gupta families to get business from government. And then I said, this man is not telling the truth. And that's when I decided to actually come out, because I realized that something bigger was going on in this country. And unless people like me stood up and expose the rot that was starting to emerge, things were going to get worse. And I started speaking out about my experiences with Zuma and the Gupta family.
Okay. Before we just tease you a little bit about the speaking out, you mentioned an incident in which one of the Gupta brothers led a government delegation physically around the BRICS conference. That was not the first time that the Guptas were seen to be the leaders of a government delegation. The same thing we had noticed or heard of in a foreign trip by the Zuma administration to India.
Yeah. Look, when I was at GCIS, we're responsible for the International Marketing Council, IMC, now known as Brand SA. And we started playing a key role in making sure that there were common messages. Whenever there are global fora, there are common messages that emerge from government and business delegations. When the trips were being arranged after Zuma was appointed, I could see that the Gupta family was starting to take charge of the process. The India trip was particularly, I think, embarrassing for all South Africans if they get to know what the story was, because the Gupta, Ajay Gupta in particular, took charge of the arrangements for the trip. And when they got to India, they then sent out a message to both Indian government and Indian business leaders that if they want to get anything out of the South African delegation, they needed to speak via Ajay Gupta. South African ministers were told if they wanted to interact with Indian businesses and the Indian government, they also needed to speak to Ajay Gupta. So you find yourself in a situation where instead of the Department of Foreign Affairs, DECO, the Department of Trade and Industry being the key departments in charge of the trip, Ajay Gupta usurped that role and actually started being the link between government, South African business, and the Indian government and the Indian businesses. So he put himself in a position where they became the organizers of that whole trip, something that is totally irregular by any standards. I don't think that any government in the country operated like that, but they used their connections and relationship with Zuma to actually charge of that whole operation.
Okay. And then you speak out. What are the consequences of that for you emotionally and financially?
Well, the impact of speaking out is quite huge, but it's not an easy thing to talk about, because the more details you give, you run the risk of scaring public servants who are in the system from speaking out, because when they start realizing what the consequences are, chances are that many of them may not speak out. I know for a fact that before the Public Protector Tulima Tonsela's report came out and before the Zondo Commission was established, I met with a lot of government officials, current, then, and former government officials, and many of us agreed that we were going to appear before the Zondo Commission. But when the commission started, very few people were able to come out. So the issue about speaking out is that, you know, you got to think about a lot of things. One is the financial impact. When you lose your source of income, people have to think about bonds, fees for their kids at schools, their car installments. And if you speak out and lose your job, chances are that, in fact, a lot of those things are going to be at risk. I had to bear the responsibility of finding alternative sources of income, because when you speak out, it become and you lose your job, it becomes difficult to find employment in other parts of the public sector, SOEs and other parastatals. I was disappointed to realize that, in fact, private sector also don't want to employ what they term whistleblowers, because we're seen as a political risk. So finding a job became impossible. I almost gave up on it. A few friends of mine tried to get me into boards of private sector companies and even SOEs, but it became very clear that I had become an enemy of the state, and no one wanted to touch me. So all my applications for jobs, I'm sure, ended up in the bottom drawer. You also experience political isolation. So people in the political circles that I used to be part of battle to be seen to be associated with you, because they fear that if they're seen to be associating with a whistleblower, they'll be seen to be working against the state in somehow. So I found political isolation being very difficult. So I think the personal impact is quite huge for a whistleblower.
What can be done to improve the environment in which whistleblowing takes place, so that people don't suffer what you went through? I spoke to Musilo Mutepu, who just wrote a book, and she tells very painful tales about her experience as a whistleblower. What do we need to do as a country to protect whistleblowers?
Well, I think that you need to, the first point is to review the current legislation. We've got legislation which is meant to deal with the protection of whistleblowers, but it talks about it simply from a point of view of labor relations, that you can be fired. But there are other things that need to be looked at to strengthen the legislation. I mean, the whole notion of, for example, a whistleblower being defined as a politically exposed person, which basically means that you can't raise funds to start a business because you're seen as politically exposed. You can't get a loan from a bank to do anything. So we need to change legislation. We need to also find a way where civil society in particular is given resources, preferably by big business, to actually support whistleblowers, because a lot of them face a lot of legal challenges. And some whistleblowers are sued by their employers. And remember, whistleblowing is not just the public sector, but also blowing a whistle in the private sector as well. So they end up being sued, so they need legal fees. Whistleblowers have kids at school. Fortunately, in my case, my kids were already out of school, so I didn't have school fees issues to worry too much about. So their families end up suffering. In terms of education, they don't have money to even service their bonds. So people run the risk of being kicked out of their homes. Now, these are people who have provided an important service to the nation by exposing corruption. There's also psychosocial support that is required. I mean, some of the whistleblowers, there are cases of whistleblowers who have died for speaking out, who have been killed, and their families are destitute. Their families need not just moral, financial support, but they also need psychological support. And I think that if you have an agency, a body, especially operating outside of government and private sector, a civil society structure, or an NGO, so to speak, it can play an important role of providing those kinds of services to whistleblowers, but not just whistleblowers, but also their families. And lastly, we got to find a way of changing the culture in society broadly for encouraging people to speak out and expose corruption. We need to encourage citizens to behave ethically, morally and identify acts of corruption and expose them wherever possible. And that has to do with the culture that we need to inculcate among kids as early as pre-primary school. Families need to play an important role of promoting not just whistleblowing, but also ethical behavior and conduct. Churches have an important role. Government needs to come up with a program that actively encourages people to blow the whistle, not just wait for somebody to blow the whistle and then saying what support do they need. We need to go out there and say, if you identify acts of corruption, you need to expose them, and that as government will be there to not only protect you, but also support you in hours of need.
Okay. Is there anything else, Putemba, you'd want to mention about this book, about where you are right now?
I think it's all in the book. I mean, I'm simply hoping that this book will encourage more and more, not just civil whistleblowers, but, you know, activists to tell their stories. Because in most revolutions, the stories of the revolution are told by observers, either journalists or academics. But activists and people who are in the trenches need to tell their own stories, their own experiences, and how those experiences have shaped who they become. And too many of our activists end up in the grave without having shared their own stories. And I think that young people need to know how we got to where we are as a country, just both from a liberation point of view, but also telling stories about how things went wrong. And people need to tell their stories. So I'm hoping that my book and many others will encourage more and more people to record history, because this is what these books are about.
Thanks for that. Thanks. If I could just give you a personal note, I'm quite passionate about the public service, public policy, and especially the recording of the experiences of people like yourselves. And we've got very few DGs who've put pen to paper for us to understand the policy system, the policy process, and it helps a great deal when people, certainly for you, it came from a lot of pain. It came from a lot. You use the term Putemba, you talk about a revolution that derailed. You talk about people like Jimmy Manyis and others who might not understand how this thing happens. Is that a sense you have that the revolution derailed?
I think that we've made a lot of progress as a country, and I think we can't deny that. There's greater access to water, housing, and sanitation than we did during apartheid. But I think that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to improve the livelihoods of ordinary South Africans, the poorest of the poor. Conditions out there are still tough for the majority of South Africans. And I think that where we begin to talk about the revolution being derailed is when you start seeing a lot of activists and leaders of political parties, especially the ruling party, and people who are ending up in government being driven not by the vision that we had in 1994, but driven by personal interest, people wanting to make a better living out of the jobs that they have, instead of using those jobs to improve the lives of ordinary people. The fact that we're being counted as among the most corrupt countries in the world, and the people who are spearheading that corruption are former revolutionaries, it's something that is very painful to observe and watch. And none of us ever thought that ANC leaders would be implicated in the acts of corruption that we're seeing to this day. The fact that the levels of service are declining in many parts of the government system is something that is of great concern to me. The fact that, you know, many South Africans are still unable to establish the link between the levels of corruption that we're seeing and poor service delivery, it's very sad, because the reason why we aren't able to provide enough textbooks to our schools, to fisk our schools, to solve problems of potholes that exist, to make sure that lights are turned on every day of our lives, is largely because of the money that has been stolen from the public service. So corruption is not just something that has to be dealt with somewhere in the Zondo Commission. Corruption is having a direct impact on the lives of South Africans each and every day. The fact that we can't afford enough vaccines today to make sure that our people are protected from COVID has everything to do with the fact that money has been stolen from the public purse, and the fact that some of our activists, not all of them, our former comrades, are involved in that corruption. It's something that leads one to believe that, in fact, unless more is done to stop the corruption, our revolution will be derailed even further.
Hope? Do you have a sense of hope?
As I say in my book, I'm very optimistic. My name, Temba, means hope. It means trust. I think that there's scope for things to get better. I have absolute confidence in the majority of our citizens. I think that South Africans are very wise people. They will not allow this country to go down the drains, to go the Zimbabwe route. If you look at the voting trends over the past couple of years, you're starting to see that, you know, voters are becoming educated and they're beginning to send a signal to the ruling party that, in fact, you're not going to have this majority unless you change your ways. So I'm very optimistic that our citizens, our voters, will send a message to the ruling party fairly soon, and that's going to reflect in the election results. I'm also very optimistic about the measures that the new leadership of the ANC is trying to put in place, especially the President Ramaphosa. None of us ever imagined that a Secretary General of the ANC will be suspended on allegations of corruption. And I think that's a sign that, in fact, things are starting to turn in the right direction. The fact that you have a former president of the country appearing in court on charges of corruption is beginning to send a signal to people that those who are involved in corruption will ultimately be held accountable. Yes, I worry about the pace that it takes to prosecute those who are implicated in corruption, but I think that we're in the right direction, we're going in the right direction, and I remain optimistic.
Okay. Butema, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Mr. Maseko, for the wonderful and fascinating conversation. And really thank you for sharing your story with us and the world. All the best.